I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. You're listening to Bhavani at ieatgreen.com at the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to welcome you again on a beautiful, beautiful, hot Wednesday afternoon. I'm thrilled to be here. I have a guest in the studio with me today. His name is Kamal Vash, and he is a professor at a university in Mozambique from Maputo. And he's going to be with us later on in the session talking to us about biofuels in Africa and sustainability and farming, and we will try to see how that can relate to us. And it's just been a really interesting conversation already, so I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. So stay tuned for that. And I want to just talk to you about what's going on in the garden, because I've been out in the garden a lot lately. And I'm harvesting everything. We have the beets are coming up, all the salad greens, the arugula, tomatoes. This year I grew some beautiful, bright yellow tomatoes. Not the cherry tomatoes, but large heirloom yellow tomatoes that are just so delicious. And then I also have the Brandywine ones, which are misshapen red ones that are so sweet and delicious. And this year I also grew purple tomatoes that just have a little purple tinge to them, but they're big and red and also so sweet. So every year when the tomatoes come in, I remember why I don't eat them all the rest of the year, because they don't taste the same. So we're really enjoying eating some tomatoes and fresh basil. My broccolis are coming in really beautifully now. And I'm also getting ready to plant some more broccoli. Those of you that are doing gardening, you know, this is the time when you really want to think about what you'd like to be growing in the fall, because you can start planting again for your fall crops. So I'm going to put in some new broccolis. Last week I actually planted pumpkin. You know, my pumpkins, they take about 90 days to mature, and I figured that would be just in time for Halloween. So I put in some pumpkins, some squashes I replanted, and I also just replanted beans again. Beans are, you know, one of your early crops that come in May and early June, and then they like cool weather, so you can plant it now and you'll have it again in September. In October. So the garden is keeping me very busy. I've been working with a local school as well, trying to bring their summer rec children to a farm and doing some gardening with them. And that's exciting. You know, sometimes the kids don't know what they're in for, and they, you know, think they're going to just come play, and, you know, it is actually work. But they, once they get into it, they really have a good time and have a lot of fun, a lot of laughs doing the work. So we've been enjoying working on the garden with them. This past week also, Slow Food Huntington was proud to show the movie The World According to Monsanto. And if you ever get a chance to see that movie, I highly recommend it. It is so informative, and it is actually quite scary at how Monsanto is positioning themselves to control our food supply, not just in this country, but around the world. So, you know, it seems like they have a revolving door policy. You know, they 2 years for Monsanto and 2 years at the Food and Drug Administration. They seem to go back and forth, many of them. And so it's a real interesting relationship, and it makes you really wonder, you know, who's looking after who. And so if you get a chance, look out for the movie The World According to Monsanto. I know that you can download it. It is available on the internet as well. So, again, it's called The World According to Monsanto. And later this month, on August 31st, Slow Food Huntington is showing the movie Botany of Desire, which is a movie made out of Michael Pollan's book, also called Botany of Desire. And it actually is a plant's perspective on who's supporting who. And so it's really written from as if you were the plant, and how the plant has made us conform to what their needs are. So it's pretty interesting, and I'm looking forward to that, and we will have a speaker afterwards. So if you are in the New York area, please come on out and see Botany of Desire. There's also a beekeeping workshop this weekend, Saturday, August 7th, sponsored by NOFA, Northeast Organic Farming Association, out on the North Fork at the Hamlet Organic Farm. So if you are out on the East End or somewhere in the New York area and you're interested in raising bees, that would be an interesting thing to come to. And then, of course, Saturday, August 14th, we have the Long Island Beer Fest coming up, also on the North Fork. So that is, you know, a big festival of all the microbreweries that are local to our area. So that should also be really great. So I want to share with you some wonderful summer recipes that I have that add a lot to the salads. In this hot, hot weather, sometimes you just don't feel like eating hot food. So one salad I've made quite a bit this summer is a watermelon, mint, and feta salad. And I know it sounds like a weird combination, but it's really great. And it's so nice to actually eat watermelon in a salad form instead of only as the dessert. So this recipe is very simple. As all salads are, that's another nice thing about making salads, is it keeps you out of the kitchen for too long. So, and you don't have to turn on the hot stove. So all those reasons make salads really a great way to go. So the ingredients you need for this mint, feta, and watermelon salad is one medium seedless watermelon. And if you only have one with seeds, of course, that's fine too. You just want to try to pick out the seeds so that you can eat it without worrying about the seeds. 1/3 cup of balsamic vinegar. And for this recipe, I look for the white balsamic vinegar just because I like the color of the pink from the watermelon and the white from the feta cheese. And if you use the regular balsamic vinegar, it gives it all a brown hue, which is not as pleasing to the eye. So if you can find white balsamic vinegar, it tastes just as delicious and it will look prettier. And then you want juice of a half a lemon. And sometimes I put in the whole lemon, depending on the size of the watermelon. So all these proportions are subjective. So again, you know, let me remind you that as the chef, you are the boss, and you get to put as much in or as little in as you want. So adjust it for your own likes. Then you want 2 tablespoons of olive oil, salt and pepper to taste, 1 red onion, or you can use a Vidalia onion, but a sweet onion, and you want to chop that up. 1 pound of feta cheese, and I recommend cutting it into small little cubes. It looks much prettier that way. The first time I made the salad, I just crumbled the feta cheese, and it, again, just looks messy. So visuals is always as important as the flavor when you're cooking, so you want to keep that in mind. So the little small cubes looks really nice. And then a medium bunch of mint leaves, and you want to chop those up. Or you can chop them, you know, really fine if you'd like, and mince them. And then you're just going to first cut the watermelon into 1-inch cubes and drain it in a colander, you know, but put a bowl underneath the colander so you catch all those delicious juices that are going to drip out of the watermelon, and save the juice because it makes a great cool drink afterwards. Just put it over a little ice and it's delicious. So drink the watermelon juice. Meanwhile, you want to whisk together the balsamic vinegar, the olive oil, and the lemon juice in a bowl. You can add some salt and pepper into the salad dressing. And then when the watermelon has finished draining, you want to mix that up in a large bowl with the small cubes of feta cheese, the onion, and the mint, and mix that up. You can chill it for a few hours before you serve it if you'd like, or you can serve it right away, and drizzle the salad with the dressing right before serving, again, to keep it looking as nice as possible. And you can add some more salt and pepper to taste at this time, and that is it. Simple, 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 and delicious. So I really recommend giving this salad a try. And another salad that I've been making, also because I've been harvesting my beets, and the beets are just so delicious. This year, actually, I'm growing a couple different beets. I have golden beets. I also have these beets that are where you can see the different colored circles. When you cut it open, it's white and red striped. Really beautiful beets, and I don't remember the name of it. And then, of course, the red beets. So you want to cook the beets up for about 20 to 30 minutes just till they're soft, and then let them cool. And you want to peel them with your hands. You can use a scraper if you want, or a knife. Sometimes I'll use some rubber gloves so that my hands don't get stained red, but if they do get stained, it does come off eventually, so that's okay too. You also want a log of plain goat's cheese that you can crumble, some apple cider vinegar, about a tablespoon of honey, 2 tablespoons of orange juice, 2 tablespoons of canola oil, some cilantro or parsley, and some salt. And so when you finish boiling the beets and you peel them, you can cut them to small bite-sized pieces. And then you're just going to splash it with some vinegar. Add the honey, the orange juice, and the canola oil. Toss it with the crumpled goat's cheese, and voila, that is it. You can add the cilantro and parsley. Again, to taste, I usually start with about 1/4 cup of either one. And add some salt. And that is it for the beet and goat cheese salad. Also another wonderfully refreshing, sweet salad for the summer. So enjoy these recipes. And now I want to introduce my guest, Kamal. Hello, Kamal. How are you?
Hi, Bhavani. Thank you. I'm fine.
Good. So I'm so glad you were able to make it and join us in the studio. We've had a lot of conversations over the last week about farming and sustainability, and especially after seeing this movie last week, The World According to Monsanto, it really got me going, because in that movie they talk a lot about the farming in this country and the conventional farming and the GMO seeds that Monsanto produces, and then they talked about how they've taken that system basically out onto the road and have gone into many third world countries with it, whether it's Mexico or India. And I was happy to hear that that doesn't seem to be happening in Mozambique right now. But you were saying to me that, you know, when those packages do come to your country, they do seem to be appealing. Mm-hmm. Because so many of the people in your country farm on a regular basis just for their own food, right? How many did you say of, like, you have a population of what, 22 million?
We have 22 million, and approximately 80% of the population lives out of agriculture farming. So it's really a farming country.
And when you say they live out of it, it's not that they make their living on it. It's just that that's how they get their food.
Yeah,
right?
It's called subsistence farming. So they mostly produce for their own needs, and a very small amount could be traded in a market.
Uh-huh.
So it's really to subsist.
Right.
And just giving a little context to Mozambique. Mozambique is in the south, near South Africa, facing Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. It's a subtropical country, and it has great potential for farming, but agriculture is made on a very rudimentary stage. You know, we don't use much inputs.
You don't use much in what?
Inputs. You know, uh-huh. We don't. It's the farmer mostly uses the hoe and uses the seed that they grow year after year. You know.
So they save their own seeds.
Yeah, they save their own seeds. So it's a very, you know, they don't spend much, but they don't produce much also.
Uh-huh.
So a family of 5 people can mostly farm an hectare or an hectare and a half. And they mix the crops, so they don't only produce one crop, they produce various crops that are needed for their subsistence farming. But on average, they take out from each hectare, they take out 800 kilos of maize, for example, which if you account for 360 days divided by 5 people in the average family, it's not much. So it's we are trying to look for other ways to promote development.
And now, is most of the soil in your country, is it fertile? Or, I mean, when you say you have a subtropical climate, do you have a lot of rain, or is it a lot of arid areas?
Yeah, we have areas where it doesn't rain much, and we have areas that are very potential for agriculture. But being in a coast, we have a 3,000-kilometer coast, so we have the size of two Californias, okay? And the population of half of what California has. So we have 22 million. And 3,000 kilometers of our country is along the coast. And it's very plain, and we have a very problematic area in the coast, which is makes difficult to do agriculture. Because of salt influence. Okay, so it's very sensitive soils in some parts, so we have to be very careful when we irrigate or when we treat with fertilizers. So, but at the same time, as I was telling you, we are looking at ways to bring more money to the farmers' pocket. So we want them to be more capable of taking decisions. As we discussed, the country is discussing now and strategizing a new strategy called the Green Revolution that is being done in India, for example, in other countries, and with some various results. So we are trying to see if we can have the right strategy for the country.
Right.
We know that, as you mentioned, some companies bring their own packages and make the farmers very dependent on those packages. And they become sometimes, slaves to the...
Dependent. Completely tied
so
in.
So we have to look at ways where... They don't become so dependent.
Right. And the Green Revolution, I mean, it's funny because as someone who has, you know, been doing gardening only for the last 10 years on my own, you know, and I think of, you know, all the green markets, and so when people say Green Revolution, you know, I think of the movement that's happening now in this country of people trying to become urban you know, self-sufficient homeowners that are growing their own food. But really, the Green Revolution really refers to the introduction of agribusiness in this country and monocrops and high technology and high-yielding seeds, GMO seeds, and heavy use of fertilizers. And so it gets everybody, you know, so it's interesting in this book, I mean, in this movie, The World According to Monsanto, they talked about the Green Revolution... you know, came to India, and everybody had these high expectations that it was going to help them. But, you know, one benefit I think Mozambique has is that you can actually look at how it has worked in India and possibly save your country from going down the same bad path that India has gone down.
Yeah, I think you're right. It has two sides of
like
of
everything.
The coin. I think the Green Revolution was the father of the Green Revolution was an American called Norman Borlaug.
Right,
and he passed away a few years ago, but he left very important, lessons to us. And he mentioned that the Green Revolution doesn't need to be, you know, reciprocated from one country to another. A Green Revolution is a strategy that you use in your agriculture to make more from less, okay? More production from less inputs.
Right.
And if you're careful, you can do it well. And that's the discussion that nowadays. Sorry. Nowadays we are doing, when we do most industrial crops, is how much of the resource you have to use, and how much of the pesticides you can use, and how much of the fertilizer you can use. So all those issues that, you know, we didn't know anything about 50 years ago become a very important aspect of the equation. So the other aspect that I wanted to bring to you is that Mozambique is also opening the country for large investments in agriculture, and one of the sectors that we are looking at the development of biofuels based on crops. And I would like to also to discuss a little bit of this, because it brings a lot of ethics and maybe of concern of the whole world, you know, why we're doing the biofuels, and how these biofuels can be also an important strategy to bring more money to farmers, to local farmers.
Mm-hmm. And also, you as the professor of energy in Maputo, your specialty is really looking at everything from, you know, when you're looking at it, as you said, energy put in versus energy taken out. And so you really are measuring the sustainability when you are going into this. You're not going in blindly. You're really looking at and measuring the, you know, the cost of a tractor and the mining of the metal and the cost of the gasoline and, you know, all the different aspects that go into this kind of production.
Yeah, that's right. When we do bioenergy crops, one of the first things that we try to do is how much energy do we have to put in the system, and how much energy can we take out of the system? And that has to be balanced in a positive term. You want to put less energy and take more energy out. That's
right.
That's what makes the
business.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So the more you can take out and the less you can put in, the more
profitable and more appealing
business.
It is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the very important aspects in biofuels, is how do you equilibrate this energy balance. I know that some countries like the U.S., they produce with, for example, with corn.
Mm-hmm.
Corn is not very, it's not a crop that is very advantageous at the point of view of the energy balance, because the ratios are not very attractive unless you put subsidies in the system. Now, we are looking at two crops in Mozambique. When I say we, our company, one is sugarcane. Sugarcane has been proven for more than 50 years in Brazil. It's a very important crop for ethanol production. And we are trying another crop, which is very new into the biofuel
arena,
which is called the sweet sorghum. It's like a sorghum, but it has more sugars than a normal sorghum, so it makes it more useful for ethanol production.
So sweet crops are advantageous for ethanol production.
Yeah, sweet crops. Yeah, because they have a lot of sugars and they can be fermented into ethanol.
Energy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, and this is what we think could be very interesting in countries like Mozambique, which the land is still not a big problem. We have vast amounts of land which are not being used, and we have a good climate also in certain regions to do biofuel production. Now, the discussion that is going around is more on less on ethics, how you do this biofuel production. Most critics come on the balance between what you use as a food stock for your
crops.
Crop. Yeah. So, for example, you know that the big problem that happened when the U.S. started to do maize using corn as a foodstock mm-hmm. for ethanol. The cost of
cost of the fertilizers and the amount of oil to produce the fertilizers uh-huh. outweighed the production of the ethanol that you could get off of the crop. So yeah. it ended up costing more energy than you got out of it, and it really doesn't work. And yet they're still selling it to yeah. the population. So the PR around ethanol production is so good, yeah. and people are buying, you know, thinking this is a great new energy source. And in reality, because they're not raising it in a sustainable way, it's not.
So, but
not
you ask yourself, how do the American farmer make money? They wouldn't do corn for losing money. They're making money out of it. So it needs to be a kind of a subsidy system to support the production of maize for ethanol purposes. Now, that brings a discussion of ethics. Is it ethical to do so? Is it
to subsidize?
Yeah, to subsidize the farming. And it brings also the discussion, is it sustainable to do so, you know? When we consider the biofuels, one of the first points that we discussed is how can we have options to fossil fuels. That was our first intention. Mm-hmm. Is okay. We know that the fossil fuel run is going to
run out at some point.
Out, yeah.
We need to come up with something else.
So you need to come up with ideas to to start reducing the dependence of dependence on fossil fuels. So one option was looking at biofuels. So I think if you consider that, I think biofuels can become one option. You know, for example, the U.S. now mixes 10% in all the fuels is mixed with the ethanol. 10% of the fossil fuel is mixed mm-hmm. with ethanol. This ethanol comes from in this case in the U.S. comes from corn. But for example, in Brazil, the ethanol comes. They have cars that run 95% on ethanol, and it comes mostly from sugarcane, which is very a very attractive model to substitute fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the crop that you choose, okay? Mostly, I can understand why U.S. went for corn. Corn is the number one crop in America, I guess, and it has been established long, long ago. I think U.S. puts corn all over the world.
Yeah, well, actually, when you talk about that, one of the things that we touched upon also is because of the subsidies, corn that we grow here is all over the world, and most of it, as you know, is genetically modified. So yeah. it's also it's not organic corn that is just the corn. It's organic corn. I mean, it is corn that is spliced with pesticides, so that when you're eating it, you're also eating, you know, the chemicals. But on another note, the fact that it's subsidized means that it goes in and it competes in these other third world countries against farmers that are not being subsidized, so that the local farmers can't compete monetarily mm-hmm. or they can't compete in the market and make any money on the corn. They have to end up selling their corn so cheap to beat the American price that it puts them out of business.
Yeah, it's also sovereignty of countries is a very important aspect. Mozambique is far away from being a sovereign country, and I say that very easily. Just focusing in the agriculture sector, we're talking about farming and agriculture, and the government understands that. And one of the ideas that they want to start implementing is is to make the farmer a little bit more independent of the vagaries of the climate. You know that climate change became a point of discussion on every environmental discussion, and every scientist discusses the issues on climate change. Climate change has brought most problems to some countries than better improvements to countries. So we with climate change we have a negative impact because it doesn't rain on the normal seasons. It rains very irregularly, and some of the floods that we're getting now, it's being discussed as an effect of
and that's happening
change.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
floods.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Right here in this country. I mean, it's just amazing. And then where was that?
Pakistan.
Just this week.
China. Yeah. So all these issues, you know, makes us think that there is a few important aspects related to the environment that we have to start to look at. And that is the everything is connected. You were talking about food, I was talking about biofuels, and now we're talking about climate change. And climate change is one of the forces that puts the human being to look for other sources of energy.
Right.
Than the fossil fuels. You know, one of the causes of climate change is the burning of fossil fuels. So we are looking at other ways to produce a liquid fuel that is not so
taxing on the environment.
Yeah, on the environment. And that brings the discussion. That's why we went and explored and invest. We are still investigating these two crops and looking at the possibilities for using them on a large scale. Okay.
So we're going to take a break for just a few minutes, and when we come back, I want to get into that. I want to talk about the biofuels. I want to talk about the climate change, the sustainability, and how it's all connected, because it is really a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Yeah.
All
right.
To a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network. Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day for MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there for B-Square.
The This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing, talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
To a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi everyone, welcome back. I am in the studio with Kamal Vash, who is a professor of energy from Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo, Mozambique. And he is also the managing director of Verde Azul, a consulting firm in Maputo that works on projects having to do with the environment and social resources. And looking at things from an environmental perspective. And so I'm really thrilled to have Kamal here because, as you all know, I'm always looking at the connections that we have around our food sources and where our food comes from and local versus organic and, sustainable versus conventional and all the different nuances that are connected to our food production. And it's really interesting to hear how it is happening in a country where 80% of the population depends on their farming for their everyday existence. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really great having Kamal here. And so welcome back, Kamal.
Thank you. Yeah.
So we were talking about biofuels and how in your country you're looking at using sweet sorghum for biofuel, and you're saying that that's better than corn.
Than corn. First of all, sweet sorghum is a grass. It has a very good efficiency to transform the sun rays into carbon.
And then also you were saying you can still use the top part of the sweet sorghum as a grain.
Sweet sorghum, becomes very important because it can be used either for food or for biofuels.
Now, when they're using corn in this country, are they using the crop for anything other than the ethanol production? Or do they take the corn first and use the corn and then just the stalk is used for the biofuel?
Here is mostly the maize that is used for ethanol. There, the sweet sorghum has the advantage that the cane that is produced is used for the ethanol part, and the grain can be used for food. Mm-hmm. So that is the big advantage in terms of the polemics on the food. The other advantage of using sweet sorghum is sweet sorghum is very adapted to arid countries, and it has been a crop that has been used since hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay, these varieties have been developed in such a way that they produce more sugar content than the other sorghums. That's why we call it sweet sorghum. The other advantage of sweet sorghum is that in 4 months you can have an harvest, whilst if you talk, for example, about sugarcane, it is a crop that is on the field for 6-7 years. But you can only harvest after the first year. So for the farmer, this is a very important aspect because he can get cash in his pockets immediately after 4 months.
Mm-hmm. So sugarcane, you have
sugarcane. You harvest various times. Okay. Uh-huh. Sweet sorghum. We have been trying the last experiments that we did. Sweet sorghum is a crop that depends on the sun. Okay. So it does well when there is a lot of hours of sun. But in the winter time, the crop starts not giving so well. So we need to find either hybrids or varieties that are more respondent, or are not varieties that are not so sensitive to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's called photosensitive varieties, or not, or no photosensitive. Mm-hmm. So that's the other trick that we need to do in our investigation, is to find crops that can be used not only during one season, but more than one season.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could change the crops, couldn't you? Like do
yeah,
one the crop for the summer season, then another crop that's more adaptable yeah, for less the, sun in yeah, the winter.
So that is also a possibility. But when you talk about the industrial crops, we are talking about large tracts of land with one mechanization process. So if you put another crop that is completely different than the original crop, then you are multiplying all your costs and all your machinery and all your operations.
Oh yeah, you wouldn't use yeah, the same operations for sweet sorghum versus another grain? You can just adapt?
You could do another grain, but you could not do a crop that is very different.
Different, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it has to be all the morphology of the crop has to be very similar.
Right.
So that's why when bioenergy companies do these crops and do this business, they look at energy crops. They're not willing to go into other crops that are not their core business.
But the other thing that we were talking about was with monocrops, you have the problem of that happens when you have a monocrop.
Yeah.
And by not doing what your farmers do naturally, which is having a diverse crop, the land gets depleted of the nutrients that it needs. And so that's why you become dependent on fertilizers.
Yeah.
So is there a way to try to install a whole national composting program? Mm-hmm. I mean, like in this country as well. I'm not just saying just in Mozambique, where everybody's saving all their raw ingredients from, all their vegetables and scraps. One, it would make less garbage for the landfill, but it would also, be able to create fertilizer that one doesn't use fossil fuel to create the fertilizer, and also would not have the detrimental side effect of the runoff that happens when you use these fertilizers. Because that's the other thing. When you have vast quantities of land, but what will happen down the road if all of a sudden you're growing these, acres and acres of monocrops that you now have to put these synthetic fertilizers on, then you have the runoff of all those crops. And I know years ago you were very involved in a project that was looking at the
River
and all the pollution in the river, and with it being downstream, you seemed to get, the water when it was more polluted and less less flowing. So, your location of the country hasn't changed, so you would find yourself in a situation where you're going to have all that runoff of all the pesticides and herbicides in your water.
Yeah.
And then what?
Intensive agriculture has been blamed for most of the pollution in rivers and groundwater, and it's been true in America, it's been true in all the intensive agriculture countries.
Right.
Of course, we don't want to do the same mistakes that were done by countries that were developed, so we want to learn a little bit more and try to avoid all those problems. When we're talking about biofuels, bioenergy, there is a great advantage because almost everything is used. What is left over from the industrial process of the ethanol? You can use the feedstock after you take your syrup out. You do the fermentation. There is a feedstock that is left over, and you can either use for producing energy, or you can use to do compost. And you can really arrange models that are mixed up, so you can see what partitions of that feedstock can be composted, what parts can be produced in electricity. So finding the best model, it will take some time, but people have to be aware that, you know, whatever you take from the soil, you have to replenish it.
Mm-hmm.
And you should try to replenish in natural ways instead of pressing with industrial mechanisms that are artificial.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you try also to avoid to intensify in such a way that runoff is affected. You know, if the crop doesn't really need so much fertilizer or so much nutrients, you shouldn't put those nutrients back in the soil, because you know that with the rains they are going to be washed away and they go immediately to the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
So getting to know your system is one of the most important aspects. So research on that has been done in every country, and it affects the money balance. The more you use in fertilizers, the more you use in chemicals, it's going to affect your cash balance.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to spend money in things that you know that it's going to be run away.
Right. Well, also, so, you have to be so wary of companies like the Monsantos,
yeah,
who, they're almost like drug dealers. They get you hooked.
Mm.
And they subsidize it. You know,
yeah.
So when they introduce it to you, you know, it's like, oh, here, you know, have it. It's real cheap. They make it cheap. They make the fertilizer cheap. And slowly they raise the price, and you become dependent on it.
Yeah.
I know another incredible documentary that I saw, One Man, One Cow, One Planet,
mm-hmm.
Was a great documentary about a man's, life mission to go to India and help the farmers there who were really stuck in this revolving
circle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they couldn't quite get out of it. And you saw some of the farms that had been farmed in this industrial way,
mm-hmm.
year after year after year, and they're completely hard, caked,
mm-hmm.
hard. I mean, they looked dead. Like, the soil just was so depleted.
Well,
there was nothing. You couldn't grow anything on it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so much a fertilizer can do, even. I mean, you know, and this man, you know, his way was through biodynamics, and, you know, and they put lots of different organic preparations back into the soil, and they were able to bring it back, but they brought it back through composting and through manure and through, you know, really replenishing the soil in a natural way.
Mm.
But, you know, this green revolution is just amazing if you can look at how it affected some other countries, so that you can protect yourself from the road some of these other third world countries have gone on.
Yeah, more and more online with that, what you just said, biodynamics is conservation agriculture is one aspect of the farming system that has to be approached. You know, conservation agriculture is a technique that you use in such a way that you disturb as minimum as possible the soil structure, and it has great advantages. One of the advantages of conservation agriculture is that you don't disturb the soil, and therefore,
meaning you don't
rototill,
you don't turn it,
you don't till the soil, you just. It's the other term that is used, which explains it better, is zero tillage. you plant your seed directly into the soil,
right,
without disturbing it. So this is what is picking up now in some systems in the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
It has great advantage because you don't spend much energy doing the farm
tractor
operations.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, when the rains come down, you don't lose much soil to erosion because the soil is not disturbed. So you conserve all this water, you conserve all the structure. And if you can control all the weeds in your plots, then you are in business.
Mm-hmm.
And this can become really our green revolution. That's what I say, that our green revolution has to be backed on different premises than 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Really something that is adapted to what the farmer culture is and what the climate is of the country and what the marketing system is in the country. You know, you are bringing about the Monsanto and the dependence on the crops, on the packages that they bring. One of the biggest aspects in countries like ours is that we don't have a marketing system very well created. You know, you go to places where there is no roads, there is no telephone contact, there is no communication. So the farmer is really stuck with his own package. He needs to have seeds that can be propagated every year. He cannot depend on seeds that he needs to buy on every year, because
right,
he can get stuck. He doesn't get to the marketing system every year, and those systems fail also.
Right.
So if you depend on hybrids, for example, and you don't get the seeds every year, you starve.
Right.
That,
right.
Those communities can starve.
What Kamal's talking about is like Monsanto has developed the terminator gene, they call it. You know,
okay,
the seeds that don't reproduce.
Yeah.
And you become totally dependent on them to buy the seeds every year.
And imagine that this is already bad, but if you are in a country where the marketing system doesn't work, then it's even worse, because the farmer is left with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have his original seeds because he got rid of it, and
right,
he doesn't have the other seeds.
Right. And for most of them, it's not even their livelihood, is their food.
Yeah,
it's
a
substance.
Yeah, exactly. That's the
right. And I was actually asking you, people that live in the cities, you know, how do they farm? And you were saying that you know, you can get outside the city pretty quickly.
Yeah. So they take a chapa. We call it the chapa. Is a public transportation, and in half an hour or an hour you're out of the city, and the families usually have land that is allocated to their families by family roots, or you know,
right,
so they usually have one or two members of the family that does that. So it's a system that has some risk aversion, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
are there any programs developed in the country to help the farmers that are not looking to do the monocrops and do it as a big business, but when we were talking about the farmers that just grow their food for their families, you know, they're growing an acre and a half, and yet you're saying they're not yielding that much.
Yeah.
Are there lessons and things that we can do to help those farmers figure out ways, because they are doing diverse crops, they can do the companion planting to control the weeds, to control the bugs, and you know, all in a natural way. So they're actually in a good position. You know, they can grow the chickens and have the fertilizer from the manure, and have a cow or goat, or you know. Yeah. So you know, when they are not doing the industrial agriculture and they really are doing small farming, it seems that they should, you know, that they should be able to yield and learn how to do that a little bit better.
Yeah, the problem is not only in the production side, and the problem is not really in the production side. It's also in the marketing side. So the farmer today doesn't have big incentives to produce more than what he can consume because he doesn't have access to the market. So that becomes a big knot.
Okay, so he's not really looking. He's looking just to make the right amount.
So once these markets get a little more dynamic, you know, they can transport things easily and they can export things into other locations, then I think there is a potential for a more intensive system to develop.
Yeah, I guess also if everybody's growing their own food, you don't have people that are looking to buy the food. Because you said people don't have money either. Yeah, there's a lot of
So it's
poverty.
A lot of exchanges, you know. So once the country gets the marketing system figured out, I think the systems will evolve. And that has taken more time than we thought it would, you know. Markets like South Africa, where we could put our bananas or we could put our oranges, and those are not still very
established
developed,
yet.
Established. Or markets even in Europe, you know, we already export with a very modic quantities, bananas to Israel, bananas to Europe or Sweden. So these are the other part of the system that needs to be really developed.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's fascinating. You know, I really thank you so much because, you know, as someone that is loving gardening and farming and sees the potential and sees the connection that gardening has, you know, I really am encouraging everybody to try to grow some of their own food so they really get in touch with what goes into it and how... Mm-hmm. You know, how complex it is, and that there's, you know, and knowing where your food's coming from is just empowering.
Yeah.
It's just empowering. And, you know, it's wonderful that so many people in your country do get to grow their own food, but it is unfortunate that they don't have the resources to do it in a real vibrant way.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know?
That's right.
So I'm really so happy that they have you in a position to really help make some changes there that are going to be for the better, and that you know, I, knowing you personally, I know that you're not just one of these guys looking at the bottom line. That you're really looking at everything from a sustainability perspective, from a global warming perspective, and that the decisions you make are going to be for the good of your whole country and for the people. And you know, just watch out for Monsanto. They're going to try to get in there. I know they will. They're really bad, so watch out for them.
Okay.
And thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Bhavani. I think it was a pleasure to be on the air in America.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, I think our time's just about up. I want to thank you all for tuning in, and I will be here again next Wednesday. I am now, I should say, the proud mother of a married daughter. For those of you that have been listening in, you know that was coming up. So it's over. My daughter's married. I also have a son-in-law now, and so everything's great. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of the week, and I'll see you next week.